Right. So, as far as I know, this is...
This is us. Renata said she was going to join us a little late, so she will hopefully be able to appear in about half an hour. Paul had a conflict and haven't heard from others, so there we are. Few kind of organizational things. One, slight change to kind of what I said before about kind of rollout and schedule here for what's coming up. I think what we're going to do is instead of doing like the full kind of big chunk of updated across the board, we're going to probably next week. Possibly the end of this week, get to you for your review an updated chapter, most of chapter 2, which is the general part, right? So, this is like, for some of these, it's the third or fourth time, even in our current iteration of the agency, that you will have seen it. But and there'll be a very short timeline, kind of the minimal 4 weeks for review of that. And then in April, we'll issue kind of everything else, okay? So give this a little bit of front time. Again, hopefully we're nailing this down at this point, right, for culpable mental state definitions and whatnot, okay? So,
do you have any idea when the April come out, when it's June?
Yeah, very shortly after the deadline. So it kind of, add 4 weeks on to when we get out this chapter 2. And so as soon as those comments come in, we'll release them, the new one. So my guess is it's going to be, somewhere April 5th to the 15th.
In the better, I'm supposed to be out of the country April 29th through the first 3 weeks of May.
Wow, where are you going? That's a serious trip.
My wife and I, and my brother and his wife, are going to drive around Ireland.
Cool. Oh, amazing.
Amazing. Ireland.
Great. Well, yeah, so definitely.
So the sooner.
Absolutely.
At least I would need to wrap it up.
You bet. You bet. And look.
I have a Netflix recommendation. Dairy Girls. Fucking hilarious.
Dairy Girls.
Hilarious. Northern Ireland, but really funny.
Yeah, actually, we live in Southern Ireland.
For the record. For the record.
It's true, I'm on the record.
The record.
Really funny.
Excellent.
Thank you.
So,
okay. What were you saying?
Right. One thing we may be able to do, if it starts to get crunched on time, we could also stagger it, right? And so even before the final deadline for the chapter 2, to go ahead and issue and get out there the other work, that's definitely possible as well. But I think at this point I would just say look for it,
okay,
first half of April. So, all of which is to say, like, our next... So we'll get this kind of chapter 2 general part material out next week. Probably, again, maybe even the end of this week, but since that's only 2 days away now, probably next week. And that'll be the basis then. There'll be discussion of that at the April 3rd meeting, which is our next regularly scheduled April meeting. So that'll be the chance to, like, ask any questions about that chapter 2 general part. And again, shortly thereafter, you'll receive kind of the full update, and that'll be the subject, main subject for the following meetings. Again, staff is after we kind of finish this update, we're moving on to really focus on weapons and drug offenses. So, if anybody wants to get in front of that and have any ideas or particular concerns or anything of that sort, just feel free to reach out, kind of proactively in front of it. But otherwise, we're going to follow the usual procedure, and we'll.
What's the timeline for that?
So that we should get out our first draft. Again, basically as soon as the time expires for comments on the general update going out in April. That's going to be 8 weeks, or so. So, So June, you know, mid-late June, essentially, is when those we're going to aim to have out that drug and gun recommendations. And, other questions? Okay. Great. Well, with that, let's go ahead and jump in. And I didn't know if, I think, OAG had a comment. I think we totally get it. For the theft from a person. So I don't, unless somebody wanted to raise that or discuss that, I thought we'd move into the kind of the cluster of escape, tampering, and contraband, where I think there's several things we could love to kind of talk through with you guys. That's all right. Okay, so we'll go to escape first, and I'm going to let Patrice take it away here.
Okay. So there are a few things that are just either typographical or drafting issues that I could probably speed through for each of these offenses, and then a couple of questions where I wanted to clarify what everyone's positions are. So for escape, the first sort of typographical thing was that PDS raised or noticed that the consecutive sentencing provision appears to apply to people who are being arrested for escaping an officer's grasp on the street if they are serving a sentence that's a probationary sentence. It was not intended to include that circumstance and will be redrafted to make clear that it applies to people who are confined to an institution. The suggestion to use the word confinement when talking about escape from an institution and custody when talking about escape from an officer seems sensible to me. I guess I just wanted to see if OAG or anyone else had any concerns about
it. My only question was, I don't know that it's clear cut when you're escaping from a facility versus a person if you're in the person's care in the facility.
If you're in the person's care?
In other words, if I'm a law enforcement officer in a facility,
yeah,
and I escape,
sure,
then I think that either of the sections apply.
So
because the commentary seemed to imply they didn't.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. So let me first just clarify what the intended meaning was. So the intention was to really separate instances of escape from an institution for people who are confined to an institution and instances of escaping from the grasp of an officer on the street.
Okay.
And those instances where someone is running away from a guard inside an institution would not be captured by either of those iterations.
That's not really what I meant. Let's
okay.
say you were in the officer was ready to take you out to the sally port.
Okay.
And you see the door open and you break and you run through the sally door at that point. You're both in the law enforcement's custody and you're still in the facility, aren't you?
So that would fall under the escape from an officer as opposed to escape from an institution.
Even
so if they're
not in the institution?
That's escape from an institution, because that's why you're there.
That's why I was asking.
But it's not, I mean, partly because custody has to do with arrest. You're not under arrest with that officer. You're under confinement. So presumably what you're running from is the prison. That's what the door is.
And I'm just not sure it's worded that that's clear. I didn't have actually a problem with PDS's suggestion about changing the confinement and custody part. But I wasn't sure that, as currently drafted, that was clear.
I will try to clarify that. I guess I wanted to find out, just to be clear, whether there was any concern about not treating an escape from an officer inside of a jail as escape from an institution. If the person is trying to get out, maybe it's an attempted escape, but it wouldn't be considered an escape from an institution if a CO is chasing someone
within the institution.
Inside, correct.
Okay.
The PDS recommended defining custody I guess that the first time I drafted it, the reason I didn't include a definition of custody is I just wanted to avoid confusion with the connotation of the words arrest and custody in the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment context. But I understand the point about just trying to make much clearer in the statutory text what the holdings were in Davis and Mack about custody. And so I wanted to find out what OAG and USAO's positions were on the proposed definition.
I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. And I guess the larger questions then are with respect to grading the offense. We have the scenario where someone actually gets out of an institution, the scenario where someone is sort of fleeing or eluding an officer on foot, and then the failure to return or failure to report. The way that we graded them in the first draft treats sort of running from an officer on the street or leaving the institution as first degree and failures to return or failure to report as second degree escape. And sort of the policy reason for that grading distinction was the risk of harm from a hot pursuit of a person who is running out of an institution or running away from an officer on the street. Reasonable minds have differed and could continue to differ about whether it should be graded differently than that. But I wanted to find out for the record just what OAG and U.S. Attorney's Office's positions were on how it should be graded. PDS suggested that running from an officer on the street is sometimes much less serious than actually leaving a facility.
And that's the question is, what does it mean to run from somebody on the street versus a facility? So if a person bolts from the transport bus that's going from D.C. jail to the courthouse, they're not bolting from the facility, right? They're bolting then from the law enforcement.
No, they're bolting from the facility.
Well, then we need to rewrite the definitions to say that, because I don't read a bus as a facility. How about if
that's not the issue? That's not how I don't understand it to work that way, right? It's about authorized confinement, right? So if you're on a transport bus, presumably you were confined. It's about sort of leaving when you don't have authority to do it. Custody is defined about arrest. So I think that's I see what you're saying. I guess I assumed that wasn't about law enforcement. That was still escaping from the facility, because that's where you're authorized. That's where the court order has you placed.
Right. Maybe can I interject and just say, like, at the most basic level, I think the question is take the Heartland case. There might be like difficult things where it's like there's a transportation between, you know. But the Heartland case of, like, an escape from a facility, D.C. jail, right? Like, not just saying, but D.C. jail from inside versus whatever the Heartland case is for, you know, escaping from an individual officer. And in that case, is there such a difference in seriousness that it deserves its own gradation or a different gradation for the institution versus the officer, or even in that kind of like the basic Heartland case, they're roughly the same in terms of the seriousness with which I think that's start there, and then there's the difficult problems. Okay, you know, what if it's
you're both from a courtroom?
Yeah, and then there's
running,
there's all sorts
there's,
of
you know there's people out by the escalators and there's a three-story drop.
Yeah,
and there's a woman with a baby in a
exactly
floor.
Exactly.
Come
no,
on.
So
yeah.
So men,
that actually does
it,
happen.
That actually
well,
does
well,
happen.
Many permutations, but just on base level, right? Like, you know, is the intuition that escape from an institution, right, is more serious than the normal, escape from the officer? Because if so, then we proceed to the next step. Okay, how exactly then do we, describe these? Or is it like, can't say that. You know, like, it isn't clear that there's a real significant grading difference.
To me, it seems like almost the other way. It is more dangerous to escape from a law enforcement officer than not to show back up at the facility.
So that's a
right.
Third.
So that's a, yeah.
Yeah, the failure to report.
If you're asking,
yeah.
Yeah.
In a two-penalty structure,
right.
Where would we recommend the middle one going? Or if you're suggesting that maybe there should be a three structure.
That's right. So I think that's the question.
With each one of them.
Yeah.
That's something we'd certainly consider. We'd like to see what the proposal is.
Yeah. I mean,
how that turns out.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the PDS pitch, right, is to, like, move from the current two to a new three, where at the top, pulling out of the middle one, at the top would just be the escape from the facility.
We said two. We considered three. And
oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah,
so
it was my understanding. PDS proposed just grading the running from an officer the same as failing to report or failing to return.
Right. So that, I think, we disagree with.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Well, then open it up to then, like, what about the three-part thing, which it sounds like would make the distinction PDS is pitching, but is doing it, you know, still distinguishes and says failure to return separate at the bottom, you know, escape from an individual officer middle at the top, the facility. Does that, or maybe? Is that a maybe? Okay.
Is that a maybe for PDS?
Yeah, exactly.
I was looking again at the definition of custody because, you know, it would. If this is the definition of custody, and it sounds like it's going to be, we could probably get comfortable with that. I mean, I just, you know, whatever. People run from the police. Gestures are not recorded. So you know, I disagree that it is as serious as Heartland escaping from correctional facility. But.
Yeah, I mean, we can play with so many fact patterns. There are situations where people leave a facility in much less dramatic fashion than tunneling out of the jail, right? They switch wristbands with someone and they leave that way, and so there is no hot pursuit versus someone who's running from an officer on the street and causes a three car pileup or who knows. So that's sort of where the policy decision.
Can I ask then, what does it mean to leave custody? I get what custody is, but if I'm like, just like, get the fuck off me, you're hurting me, am I leaving custody or am I just like, stop restraining me quite so forcefully? Do I really have to, leave means like, leave.
Yeah,
like,
I think.
Go somewhere.
I have to find it in the commentary, but yeah, I think I explained in the commentary, that it really refers to breaking away from the officer, like distancing
yourself. But it means
yourself.
Like no longer submitting to the lawful arrest, not just resisting the substantial restraint.
Correct. Resisting arrest is a separate offense for the scenario that you're describing.
And are
right?
we given now, looking at what we've even proposed as a definition of custody, is that going to be clear?
So what we have written now is, in the context of fleeing from an officer who's physically restraining them or whose arrest they've submitted, a person leaves when they distance themselves from the officer in an effort to avoid apprehension.
Okay. Okay. I mean, if that's
then the example
really
is, for example, a person who maneuvers her way out of handcuffs but stays seated in a police car has not committed a completed escape.
Okay.
On the other hand, a person who remains handcuffed and runs three blocks may have committed an escape.
Okay, that's helpful.
So do you think, maybe to answer this question, would confinement be more with respect to leaving the grounds in question of the correctional facility rather than it being with respect to a specific law enforcement officer holding you in custody? So for example, if I escape a dorm, it may not be entirely clear which law enforcement officer, if any, I'm fleeing from with respect to custody, but obviously if I am able to get off the grounds and I've never been discovered, let's say I do it completely surreptitiously, would the grounds of that correctional facility be a more appropriate frame of reference rather than, with respect to a specific law enforcement officer?
Well, correctional facility is defined that way, to say the building or the building grounds.
So if they get out of the building but not off the grounds, is that an escape or an attempt to escape?
It's probably an attempted escape.
They're not off the grounds.
So if they got out of one set of doors and they're still inside another set of doors, or they got outside of all the doors but they're still inside a fence, or they got to the sidewalk and then they were tackled, they didn't quite get away, so it's an attempt. Again, sort of turns on the ability of the person to distance themselves from apprehension. Professor Brown.
Don, did you have something?
That makes sense.
There you go.
Okay. All right. All right. So I guess the larger question, and this sort of applies to escape and contraband, so maybe we can talk about both of those and then tampering, but really the question is about locations that are staff secure, right, as OAG described it. We have locations like halfway houses, shelter houses, group homes, that are used to hold people pursuant to a court order, but they're not secured by locks or chains. They're secured by a staff person being there and the legal requirement to remain in that location. And there may be some different intuitions about whether staff secure locations should be included depending on which kind of contraband we're talking about. Or depending on which kind of escape we're talking about. But I wanted to really sort of pin down what everyone's position is on whether halfway houses, shelter houses or group homes should be included in escape, and whether they should be included in contraband. And if so, should that be all contraband? So the halfway houses are already included in escape as we have under current law.
So with shelter houses and group homes.
And shelter houses and group homes, and they're sort of two different statutes governing the juvenile scenario. So
those are really different questions.
Sure.
So I understand with respect to escape, I understand the question or at least the question I want to answer, whether it's actually the one you're asking, about adult versus juvenile versus whether we're covering halfway houses. So more with respect to whether escape should cover shelter houses and group homes, we strongly think that escape should not cover shelter houses and group homes. We actually think juveniles should be charged with escape at all, because that isn't the purpose of the juvenile justice system. But we feel it most particularly with respect to shelter houses and group homes. They are not the same as halfway houses. They are not places where people serve sentences, and frequently kids are placed in there because home is not either safe or sufficient supervision, and so it is a lot more about housing and protection of kids, making it a separate offense to leave that placement, we think is not at all like adults leaving a halfway house. The other thing that is sort of important, and I think relevant for understanding this, is as Dave pointed out, people are in the custody of DUIRS, or in the legal custody of DUIRS that determines their placement, and DUIRS therefore has a lot of has all of the authority to determine a kid's placement, to have an adequate response to a kid leaving a placement. This would also be true if the kid happened to walk away from YSC or New Beginnings. But it is certainly true for shelter houses or group homes that they can change, well, certainly for group homes as a commitment, can change the placement of the kid and can move the kid into to New Beginnings or to a residential facility, and that is what the consequence should be, is to have the kid be in a safer and more supervised place. We'd also say that the DYRS regulations don't treat shelter houses and group homes different. The distinction that Dave, or OAG, I should say, attempts to make between shelter houses and group homes and other kinds of community placements doesn't exist in the regs, that they are like foster care placements or other kinds of community placements. And that staff secure is sort of a fiction, in that it's not, it's, they don't stop you from going, in the same way that if somebody were to be in a halfway house and try to leave would be much more what you think of as sort of escaping from the jail. They don't just let you walk out, but you could from a kid placement. It's just, it isn't the same kind of conduct, and juveniles should be treated differently.
Would decriminalizing it for juveniles have the practical effect of preventing law enforcement officers from apprehending a kid who had escaped without getting a custody order first?
No, no. They can petition the court for a custody order, and the MPD can get them.
But I mean, if before they go get a custody order, right? So as it is now, if escape is a crime and an officer sees a kid jump the fence at New Beginnings, can run after them and arrest them for escape. If escape does not apply to juveniles at all, would that officer be able to even do that, or would they have to go get a custody order from the court?
I don't know the answer to that, but I also
don't care.
It's not that I don't care. I guess I don't think that's the most important thing in terms of figuring out how we're treating kids. That if you have a philosophy, contrary to what juvenile court's supposed to be, of just giving kids criminal records, potentially criminal history later, then have at it. But that's not what the system is supposed to be. It isn't supposed to be about punishment. It isn't supposed to be about just increasing charges. But it is supposed to be about rehabilitation and making kids safe and giving them services. And that's all possible without a new charge of escape, right? It's not, escape isn't the conduct. It's not why they're in the system. That's a sort of failure to comply with something, and that's its own thing, right? All the parents who are here, when your kid doesn't listen to you, that's not the new thing. It's the original problem that needs to be addressed, and that's what the system is for. Not for a whole new thing that gives the judge no more power, right? I mean, in the end, when you get to disposition, you're looking at what does this kid need, not like, ooh, that carries 5 years, therefore you're getting 5 years. The kid's needs aren't any different. Escape might tell you something about their needs, so serve those needs, but you can do it under the original whatever it is, drug case, robbery case, assault case, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true of all of these offenses, right? Like, just criminalizing any of these things in general, that point is sort of like a larger philosophical point about whether any of these government custody offenses should exist or not. I mean, it's equally true in adult court that you could go to the judge and complain that the person's not charging their GPS device instead of charging them with a separate misdemeanor.
You could as a condition of
a little police, but it's different. I mean, I'll just back up Laura here, right? Like, if the kid is leaving a facility, the state is failing to provide care and remedies for the kid that make them want to be in the facility. I'm not going to charge the state with abuse and neglect unless it's really severe, but the child is the charge of the state in a way that is different from an adult, because when you're an adult, right, you're making decisions prior to your custody that have gotten you into custody that are not about, that don't result in the state saying, we should take care of you. You're right that it is true that it is possible to take a philosophical approach to this, or just a different attitude towards adult offenders, but it is not consistent with the long tradition of juvenile justice to take that. It is debatable as to whether or not you can take that for adults, right? Juvenile justice is definitely independent and distinctive along the lines that Laura is describing. And so it's much easier to say for juveniles, right, that this is, you're not gaining anything by adding new charges. You're just, you know, noting that we're failing them and then adding another charge. To what end? It's not really clear.
And the sentencing possibility remains exactly the same. So what?
I feel I need to respond. First of all, there are at least two statutes currently that make escape of a juvenile facility an offense. Secondly, the entire juvenile justice, Title 16, Chapter 23, is not just about care and rehabilitation. In a number of places, it talks about public safety. And the placement of the youth under 1623.10a is a public safety decision. And when we decide, when we do things like least restrictive placement consistent with public safety, the judge has to make a determination whether they'll hold them in that hardware secure or staff secure facility. And if you take escape away from the staff secure, one, I'm concerned that that may not lead to a judge finding a least restrictive placement, because notwithstanding that sanctions argument, there is no sanction then for leaving. And the city council in 2005, you know, talked about that, the issue of what is another charge bring, when they rewrote 16.317 of the code that used to be used to, because defense attorneys made the argument that the kid's already in the system, and so what is bringing the new theft charge, bringing the new escape charge, bringing the drug charge accomplished, because they've already got, they're already on probation, already committed. And 16.317 was modified to say that that was not a consideration, or at least not a sole consideration. It would be improper for a judge to dismiss any charge based upon the fact that they're already in the system. I think that to have an escape charge is an important thing to have on a kid's record if the kid is escaping from a facility, because it says what it documents, that the kid was placed in a lesser restrictive facility and chose to leave the facility without authority. So, you know, there's depending on how we want to address this, there's a lot of different arguments for why the escape charge should remain an offense in the juvenile justice system. Well, depending on how it's charged or how it's put out or whatever is a totally different issue. But if a kid is placed in, at least the argument is made, they should be placed in the least restrictive placement, and there is no penalty for absconding from that facility, then why would the youth have a stay?
Isn't the penalty secure detention?
Right, the penalty is.
Because 16.23.10a says that the kid has to be a substantial risk to personal property. Before the city council made it substantial, then I think it was actually, I think your argument would be stronger, because then you would say, well, they would necessarily step them up into the larger one. But escape from his facility shows the kid doesn't want to remain at the facility, and it may not be the fault of the facility. It may not be neglect, and maybe he wants to be with his girlfriend that weekend. Whatever the situation is, he's not...
Right. Detention's required to secure the child's presence at the next court hearing. Not substantially secure.
No, that's the second criteria. Substantial harm to danger or others, not the... In other words, escape from a facility. So if a kid escapes from a facility but shows up to his next hearing, you're going to, his defense attorney is going to argue he's not a risk of not appearing under 1623.10a2.
Okay.
He is, he's, but he's not necessarily a stronger, substantially, more likely to substantially harm personal property. But he's not staying where he is. He's
right.
not.
But wait, you think if the kid, so one, you're, let's be clear, we're talking about predisposition at the moment, right?
Because DYRS
definitely can say, we told you to be here, you weren't, and so now we're gonna increase your level. You told you to be at grandma's, you decided to go live with mom.
But that argument is true if he punches a worker, DYRS can say, you can make the argument, there's no reason to have an assault, because DRS can deal with it and commit
assault. You're right, I absolutely
If he's using drugs in the facility, DRS doesn't, MPD shouldn't be arresting for smuggling drugs in the facility or using the drugs illegally, because DRS can do it. And that's what I was saying, 1623.17 was amended to take away that argument.
Right, we also think about juveniles and youth really differently now than we did when that change happened. So we can tackle that. I'm totally, like, let's take that one on. That, this conversation doesn't have to take on all of that. We don't have to say you can't charge the assault if the kid smacks whatever they're called in the facility, but a staff person in a facility. We don't have to take that on to say escape is about exactly sort of as I was saying before and as Don put it much more articulately, which is providing a place where a kid wants to be getting services. And if they leave from there, put them somewhere else to have them get the services and to treat them. And if that's not, and it's possible under that original offense, either predisposition with the judge or post-disposition because DYRS has the authority to do it. But what is the escape telling us? The judge has the ability, everybody has the ability to do it and saying, okay, apparently you won't stay put here. We need you to, then we're going to move you because here's where you need to stay put. And the judges have the ability to do that.
So you're saying that you could change 1623.10 to say if you leave a facility, then they can be securely detained?
No, I'm not saying that.
But then what is the option? What is the...
But what is the problem?
The problem is that you won't stay in a shelter house.
They're already held.
They're in a shelter house, under your example.
Yes.
And they won't stay there.
Right.
But how does adding a charge of...
So, David, help me understand this, Dave. So let's take your example. A kid is in a shelter house. They're supposed to stay there pending their court date for who knows what reason. Like, maybe there's no other place for them to stay.
So no, that's a different provision.
They go to see their girlfriend, and you say, I'm sorry, that's a crime. We're adding an additional penalty onto whatever it is that you were being held for previously so that they can do what? I just don't understand
the questions.
And the information, of course, is presentable in juvenile court irrespective of whether there's a criminal penalty, a crime attached to it, right? Like, all that information is available.
It's as relevant in a new charge of escape as it is relevant in the original charge. Either leaving the placement matters or it doesn't matter. But escape is a new, for the detention decision, right? What's escape as a charge? How is that a different way of understanding detention? And if it is relevant information, right? Like, there's nothing, I understand your argument to be that you have to sort of pose significant harm, right?
To be hardware secure detained.
Right. But to the extent it is relevant, that a kid has walked away from a shelter house, that is as relevant for the detention decision on a new escape charge as it is for revisiting the detention decision on the charge that had them in the shelter house in the
first
place.
And I'm not saying that necessarily a judge should securely detain them. We don't bring charges because of the detention or non-detention. This is an argument that basically says that that there should be consequences for what the kid does, whether it's merely having their record reflect their actual behavior, or whether it's something else.
It would, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but we're already in a world where criminal contempt would apply to this?
No.
Why? So I want to go back then to what mechanism does law enforcement have after seeing an escape to detain that individual and take them back to the facility they were escaping from?
They would do a custody order. The judge would issue a custody order.
Like
so they would have to just sort of note the individual has left and then do a full sweep to try to find them later. And what do we think the time is from witnessing the escape to getting a custody order?
It could be anywhere from 2 hours to 3 days, depending on which judge gets the facts.
Okay. Just want to make sure I understand then what, so regardless of, because I'm not necessarily interested in penalties as a result of a criminal offense, but I am interested in the effective adjudication enforcement of detention orders as it applies to youth. So if there's a sufficient way of detaining that youth and taking them back to the facility they were at, I think that may bolster arguments that it doesn't need to be a criminal offense, but I haven't heard a very satisfactory account of what that looks like, such that I, as a youth, could essentially veto detention orders by walking out of the facility, which seems like it could happen on a regular, frequent basis. If that happens once or twice and it becomes common knowledge that there's just simply no legal mechanism to punish you for leaving a detention facility. So what does that look like?
I don't know the answer for law enforcement authority to detain a kid before the judge has issued a custody order. It's not, what I'm reacting to is once it becomes common knowledge that there's like no legal consequence, because there is a legal consequence, you're gonna get more securely confined. You may get put in a residential placement nowhere near D.C.
So what's the penalty for trying to escape that secure confinement? So then we kick the can, though, right? So you get ordered to another more secure detention facility after having escaped before. What's the penalty for fleeing that place? What is the legal mechanism to quickly address an escape as it's ongoing?
So I think you grab the kid with a custody order. The kid comes back to court. The kid has to answer whether you're really going to show up at your next court hearing, right, under A2. But for all of these children, they are facing potential commitment through age 20. And so when you are doing this pretrial, you are ordered pretrial to stay at a shelter house, the ultimate decision that the judge is going to make, whether you have additional charges that are escape or whether you're just going on the charge that you have pending and that is predisposition, you have the option of getting probation and you have the option of getting commitment. And if you are committed to DYRS, then all these other consequences will then take place.
Then, just
what's meaningful
from a
for the kid is the thing that happened,
but the thing
right
too.
Now. Not at the moment. What's meaningful for the kid is not that you've built up their record. So there's nothing quick about an escape charge.
So I want
right? In fact, that's probably longer.
It's the opposite.
I'm just curious.
It's the immediate sanctioning by being charged for the escape. The kid's not thinking that when I get it by disposition 4 months from now, DYRS may take into consideration at some point that I walk twice from the shelter house.
And
that's not something that's going to affect the kid.
Because where you live
about
is the more immediate thing, and that's what the kid cares about.
I'm more concerned.
You used to be in a shelter house, and now you're at new beginnings.
Which is why I said if 162310A added a third one, it said you leave the facility, then you could be securely detained, you would have a stronger argument.
But I'm also concerned about the perverse outcome where, okay, so we're saying we are happy with a system where a youth could leave, there'd be no immediate response, and there's a back-end consequence. And I'm wondering if we're doing this youth a disservice by saying or signaling at the initial stage, because if you leave this facility, there is no immediate consequence. We'll just bring you back here. But you are destroying what's going to happen at a later adjudication because you have a record of now fleeing unsecure facilities. And I'm wondering, as a practitioner, would you have been more confident in a case where, for whatever reason, either a theory of deterrence that I'm not going to leave a facility for things like visiting a girlfriend, and I think there's a deeper question. So one, maybe there's something like an affirmative defense for facilities that are not actually providing the care they're supposed to. But if the routine is going to be, listen, we all accept the idea that this is going to come at a consequence of more youth leaving the facilities they've been assigned to, is that going to have the secondary effect of saying more youth are now getting committed for longer periods of time once they reach the adjudication phase because, as a matter of practice, more youth are fleeing the facilities they were initially assigned to?
And the second part is a judge in a close case more likely to say shelter house when it's substantial danger to personal property as a least restrictive placement, or they're going to say, well, if he walks from a shelter house, there's nothing, and so I'm going to keep him securely detained.
Dude,
and so,
why do you keep saying there's nothing? Why do you keep saying there's nothing? Why do you say there's nothing?
Why do you think
they can't be sent to?
Because it doesn't necessarily affect the substantial harm to personal property, and if they show up at the next court hearing,
stop right there. But in the escape, why do you think when we come to court on the escape, that all of a sudden now I'm going to end up at New Beginnings? What are the factors?
I don't think you're necessarily going to end up at New Beginnings.
So what's going to happen?
Your record is going to actually reflect your behavior that you have placed, that they tried you in a shelter house, and that you left.
So what you want is the record. This has nothing to do with a consequence to the kid or anything else. What you want is the record. That's all you've said.
No, it hasn't changed.
The consequence that matters to me, right, as a kid, is where I'm about to live. And you've just said it doesn't matter whether I have a new charge or not. Nothing can happen to me. I'm still going to go to the shelter house. Because that apparently is a fact that doesn't change. All you've done is build my record.
No, because as a practical matter, they can either detain you or not detain you. They can either put you on probation or commit you. If they commit you, DORS can do whatever they want. They don't ever have to lock you up. That is a fact of all juvenile cases. And to me, your argument isn't any stronger for escape than it is for any second or third charge once a kid's been placed on probation or committed. Because under that argument, the DORS can do whatever the hell it wants, no matter what your charges are. But that's not how the system is set up. The system is set up so that an accurate record be made of what the behavior of the kid is doing, both for public safety and for care rehabilitation.
Why don't we separate the predisposition kids and the post-disposition kids, right? Because we're sort of mixing them together. Because for the predisposition kids, what you're saying, if this doesn't get the child, the judge to say, child, now you have to be securely detained, then a new charge doesn't add anything to the secure detention decision. And so the same sort of deterrent, the same mindset of the child applies. Like, when this is over with, I want to get probation and not be committed, and therefore I'm going to get my act together and follow the rules. And that applies predisposition, whether you have a new charge of escape or whether you are just trying to do what the judge ordered you to do. The same way, if you are ordered home and the judge says go to school, you want to go to school because you don't want a worse consequence down the line, right? If the punishment is always the same in the juvenile system and the statute applies the same way, whether there's a new charge or it's your failure to comply with the release conditions, doesn't that put you in that same situation?
No, because that should be something that says for the kid, even if it's the immediate arrest and bring them into the courtroom, that is part of the learning experience that the kid goes through, as opposed to simply being returned to a facility to keep escaping again. There has to be some consequence on some level.
But
even if it's not, that leads to secure detention. There has to be something that the kid recognizes they're in a different position because of
this.
Let me just have this be learning experience of the juvenile justice system.
Okay, everybody, let me interrupt. We've got a number of other issues, and this one doesn't seem to be making much forward progress at the moment. Happy to talk to each of you kind of individually to kind of like
and it
understand
apply
better.
To kids.
I'm sorry.
In no way should this apply to Penn's kids.
Okay.
Those are the
Penn's kids.
Decide,
I thought you said Penn's kids.
Should absolutely
in fact, I actually first thought you said Pence's kids. Pence kids, but that's another matter. Okay. All right. Let's
I have a couple softball questions.
Okay, yeah. So we're gonna interject some others, but we do want to keep going, and we want to have time. I also want to make sure we have time to talk at least some about the de minimis provision as the our time clips forward. So appreciate everybody's passion for their work. Great.
Okay. If we could switch gears to tampering
and I'm gonna move these down here.
Oh, great!
Just put that might help.
Is this for this season's cookies or anything?
The what?
Yeah. No. It's not just one. I'm trying to learn from my past mistakes, and I have witnesses that the wrapper was unopened.
This is like Kevin and I saw the wrapper.
Maybe less sugar, actually.
That might not help. That might not help. But sorry. Go ahead.
It will.
Yeah.
Just worried about Fight Club. Okay. If we could switch gears to tampering for a second. I guess one pretty simple issue is PDS asked about excluding liability for people who have a GPS that was issued by another jurisdiction, which is a question that I thought of when I was looking at it, but I didn't see any such exclusion in the existing law. So I think it's consistent right now with the existing law, which just says if you have a device and you tamper with it and you're in DC when you tamper with it, then that's sufficient. But I understand PDS's rationale to be essentially, you know, the district doesn't have any control over the order that was issued in another state.
Right. So, and I think the recommendation was to just limit it to federal. Was it federal or district or just district? I don't.
Superior Court.
Superior
just
Court.
DC
okay.
Superior Court.
Thoughts on that, Dave?
As to Maryland, New York, I don't have a problem with the suggestion. I don't know how I feel about federal being able to bring them into Superior Court. I like to hear what USAO has to do with that, because I sort of like the options of not keeping things in federal court when they can be litigated in Superior Court.
We do too.
So I'm just saying I don't have a position on the federal versus DC, but I don't have an objection if the person, say, is under courtesy supervision for Virginia, and they cut off the GPS. I pretty much figured that's Virginia's problem.
And doing it district or federal, would that be would PDS's proposal be amenable to that?
We thought about it. I don't know federal law. I assume they have a way of enforcing there.
I have to look again. I don't think they have a separate tampering statute, but it's so many other things, right? It's a violation of whatever the conditions are. It's perhaps tampering and obstruction, depending on how you read those statutes as well. But I have to double check.
The U.S. Attorney's Office is making clear that further federal options to Superior Court.
Do you have a preference about whether there's a district option for federal GPS tampering?
If it's brought in federal court, I'd rather have it confined to Superior Court. I think this is about giving authority. I mean, whatever, I don't like defense anyway. But giving a mechanism for further enforcement of Superior Court orders. So I do think it should be restricted. But, you know, in the end, I probably care more about the other jurisdictions. But, you know, I think federal court can be enforced by federal court in the same way the other jurisdictions can.
It may also not be a crime in federal court. They might just deal with it in terms of revoking conditions of release or revoking supervision because the judges control supervised release there. So why would we create a district offense for something that is
not
federal?
Yeah, and I don't know if Renata would know offhand either. Maybe the kind of thing we have to, like,
I can look at that.
It to
one, just sort of, when you mentioned Virginia, I think we should just look, and I'm happy to do it, at the Interstate Compact for supervision of people who are on probation, because everybody reciprocates probation supervision, and I don't think we want to make it so that D.C. isn't part of that compact and clients can't live in Maryland while being supervised?
Sure.
If that impacts
I think it makes sense to look at that, but that does seem different than, like, should it be a separate district crime, right? Or, you know, how do you think that would implicate?
Like, does it at all implicate whether they would allow supervision to be done by D.C. if this isn't a D.C. offense? I don't...
They
could still prosecute.
Like,
the fact that it doesn't happen in Maryland or whatever, Virginia, I don't know why that would prevent them from prosecuting.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as it says issued by a superior court as opposed to says you're being supervised by CSOSA, right? So the language would just be based on who issued the order as opposed to who's doing the supervision. There was a question about from both OAG and PDS about sort of how the commentary explains what alters, masks, and interferes means. That language is in the existing statute. The reason for retaining it was that I wanted to capture sort of interfering with the operation, but also interfering with the detection or the detectability of the device. And PDS sort of captured that in its explanation of interferes with the operation or the detection of the device. And so I guess I wanted to find out what everyone's preference was, having seen each other's comments, whether there was a preference for just removing alters and masks and saying instead interfering with the operation or the device's signal, or if
But still keeping both in, right? So it's either the device or the signal, like interference with either one, and then just broad, just...
And then just getting rid of alters and masks.
I don't have a problem with, or OAG doesn't have a problem with, doing it in the way that PDS suggested. The idea, I mean, really our objection was, if you're going to have definitions, and you're going to bother to have definitions like knowingly, then you should have the definition of alters in the statute of masks in the provision, because those are the essential terms of the offense. But to the extent that you could draft it in a way that you don't need to then define it, we're okay with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
on the PDS side, would that alternative way of drafting be all right too? Right, just address the concern. Okay.
And then, at the risk of opening another can of worms, there was a question that OAG raised about expanding tampering to include shelter houses and kids that are required to wear GPS but are not on release. They're being held in this staff secure location. I didn't see anything in the current statute that said that. So this like sort of list of pretrial, probation, parole comes directly from the current tampering statute. And so I was just wondering if OAG is reading the current law differently, or if you're just asking to broaden it to include kids in shelter houses as well.
Sorry, yep, I just blew it up and then lost it. There we go.
Because I know we charge it too, and I don't know which.
Yeah, I don't know if they're just treating that as
pretrial
release.
Which provision is charged? But when a guy cuts off from, you know, DRS or court social services, I know that is an offense that's charged in juvenile.
Specifically in the context of someone who has to wear it while they're at a shelter house, because certainly if they were released home or they were awaiting a disposition
hearing. Well, they're all pretrial release, predisposition. I mean, they are on probation.
I guess your comment was saying that pretrial release doesn't include people who are held at a staff secure location.
Yes.
And so that language is in the current statute, pretrial release as well. I don't see anything in the current statute that would allow you to charge kids who are in a shelter house with GPS tampering, unless you're reading pretrial release to include staff secure locations.
The question was just, again, boils down to like, we thought we'd just basically copied over, right, the list in the current statute, which I'm trying to get them side by side here so we can...
Yeah, I know.
And so if it's... But
I would need to get back to you on OAG's theory of it, but I can tell you it is currently charged when a kid cuts off the GPS at the shelter house.
Okay.
Or in a group home.
Okay.
Right. And so it's just, yeah, what in the current statute does that fit under? So it sounds like what you're saying is you're not asking for an expansion. You just want to be clear that their current practice, which somehow fits in here, remains. And I think, you know, our position is, for right now, we've covered all the, like, you know, the terms have been just kind of transferred over. So we think whichever prong, you know, you're doing this under now, we think it should still be there. And, you know, we think that shouldn't be lost in the revised version. But yeah, if you want to follow up with that, that'd be great.
Yeah. But I have to see how you phrase
that. Do I have 5 minutes? Okay, so then turning to contraband, the typo that OAG found about the detainment authority and whether that the way it was phrased in the first draft says that there's detainment authority if there's suspicion that someone possesses contraband, and that really should apply both to someone who possesses contraband and also to someone who's bringing contraband, probably more importantly to someone who's bringing contraband to the facility. So I plan to update that. The law enforcement officer who can then come retrieve the person, who they're supposed to be surrendering until a law enforcement officer comes.
Within 2 hours.
We said the Metropolitan Police Department, which I think is in the current statute. OAG asked to also include other law enforcement officers.
Law enforcement.
Yeah, so the difficulty there is just that law enforcement officer is a defined term in the RCC and includes the warden and COs and others.
I was talking, my example is U.S. Park Police.
Sure. So I guess I was just pointing out that we probably won't use our defined term law enforcement officer, but if there's no objection to also including U.S. Park Police or some phrasing that says...
Well, the reason I put it in there mm-hmm. is because under the statute, the mayor gets to decide who makes arrests at New Beginnings. That was what I was thinking about when I went into this. That's a separate grant of authority to the mayor from Congress. And for us to say MPD, we're actually usurping then the mayor's authority to distinguish. And when I gave Park Police, that was an example of where under a given mayor, they said MPD, but authorize MPD to then enter into an MOU, whatever
sure.
the hell it is, with Park Police, because they're already out. They were closer to the facility. So my comment was really to preserve the mayor's authority to decide who's going to go out there and seize whatever it is or make the arrest, as opposed to
something broader.
Caring whether it's MPD or
okay.
not.
Okay, so it's your comment's focused on New Beginnings and this current grant of authority, and we just want to accommodate that.
That's right. That's
okay.
I'm just asking PDS yeah. if they have any concern with that, because
I think
that's
a way to
law.
Word that. I wasn't aware of that as a wrinkle. And well, in any case, we're fine with figuring that out without... If there's a way to accommodate that isn't about having... I mean, it's already a somewhat troublesome provision. So keeping it narrow helps. But I certainly don't mind figuring out a way to preserve...
My suggestion really was just to put a period after police officer.
Yeah, we probably won't do that just because it's a defined term. And
police officer is?
Law enforcement officer.
That's why I said after the police officer, because then it's not the defined term.
Okay.
We'll find
that.
A drafting solution to be issue. Sure to clear, yeah, exactly, this preserve mayoral authority over who responds to New Beginnings.
Authority.
Who has arrest authority, yeah.
And it's not just juvenile, it's adult as well. So an adult who assaults a kid out of the facility or smuggles drugs into the facility, it applies to them as well.
Right.
Great. Well, yeah, we can do that. Anything else?
Yeah, just
go,
sort
no,
of...
Go ahead.
And then the last question
Hold on
about...
one second. And I missed all of this. I really did read your comments in my mind, at least I did. Do you have a statutory site to
yeah.
that authority?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
maybe that's...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not
and,
right.
and,
no,
yeah, we can...
Well,
okay.
yeah,
we'll work it
yeah
out.
I actually put in
okay.
the federal, you know, the site. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The Well, actually, let me take this other one really quickly. So PDS made a suggestion about also including in the exclusion from liability relating to controlled substances, also including syringes, devices, other things that people need to keep on them because there's a medical necessity. It seems to me that there might already be no liability there, either because the person would have effective consent to have something like that, or because a general justification defense might apply, although we haven't drafted that recommendation yet. But that being said, I guess I just wanted to find out if there was any concern from any of the other advisory group members about...
So I've got it up on the screen now, sorry.
So from our perspective, if a lawyer, an investigator has to have an EpiPen on them because they're going to break out when he's eating a peanut, then they should not be subject to prosecution under the statute. The only part that we were concerned about is to make it clear, though, that it's under circumstances for personal use, so that it can't be a defense if somebody happens to be smuggling in something and also happens to have a prescription for Adderall or whatever. So that as long as it's clear for their own use, then we don't have a problem with the suggestion.
Yeah, I think everybody read this a little bit differently than the way I wrote it, which is A is for the attorneys during legal visits. B is for anyone.
Yeah.
Right? So even if it's a person who's confined to the facility, if they have a controlled substance that they need to have on them, it would be excluded.
Let me pull up the current statute on this, because I think it's similarly written.
So here,
go ahead. I have
on the
screen.
Our stuff is also prescribed, right? Like, I'm trying to renew my kid's EpiPen prescription. I just got a $300 coupon. Like, you know the bill's going to be bad when the coupon's $300. I kid you not. So, like, that's a prescription. And as I understand it, consulting with a colleague with diabetes, same thing with, say, the needles and things like that that this colleague needs. That stuff's prescribed. So I think that sort of helps the, like, personal use. It really is for that person, and they have to have it. We also tried to narrow it to talk about, it's not just any controlled substance or any sort of syringes. It's like, I can't leave this in the locker outside. I have to have this on my person.
Yeah, man, we're not because of that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But just to be clear, so the current statute, so the E, subsection E in the current statute, it is limited to,
legal
the legal representation. But then F is the standalone A person, and that's where we have just the controlled substance with the qualification. It's prescribed to that person, medically necessary. And that's where then PDS building off of that wanted, so we have a person in the intro, and then the electronic communication device is just legal visit, attorney during legal visit. B, broader controlled substance, then they add in these other items. With the qualification prescribed to that person and medical necessity, and it's actually a little bit narrower too, even for a controlled substance, because it's medical necessity to access immediately or constantly. So that's a further kind of narrowing or qualification on the controlled substance, as well as these additional new items there.
So the only question I have, because I was focusing in on the attorney situation and not in general, is whether somebody in open population at DOC is allowed to have a needle, because they can use the needle for other things, and so I don't feel competent to speak. I didn't do any research on that, on a defendant.
On how they do it now.
How they do it now. Because I may have a needle that is prescribed to me so that I could take... Oh, I don't know how they allow it, whether they have to check the needle out, but that the needle is then not held for some other purpose. So I don't particularly have an objection to the concept, but I want to know what the practice is right now about them being allowed, the inmates themselves, to be allowed to have needles and syringes.
Yeah.
I think the current practice is that they cannot have that in their cell, that you have to go to the infirmary for anything that's regularly administered, and then just anyone who has an allergy is just sort of left to hope for someone from the infirmary to get there quickly enough.
Then I would want to hear DOC's comment about how the safety about having inmates have needles.
You had,
but this isn't letting them. I mean, presumably there's still disciplinary regs within the facility. It just wouldn't necessarily, but like that's true of a controlled substance, right?
Yeah.
If I, it might not be a new offense that I've got whatever drugs, but I probably, you know, but if I have them out in open population, like I could trade them, I could deal them, it's something, but presumably it's not that, you know.
But the reason I'm saying this is I don't know what the concern are about a needle as a weapon, right? Something with a point on, you know, a blade point and whether they want people, you know, whether. So that's why controlled substance, right?
It's probably not prescribed to the person.
I'm not debating it. I'm just saying I don't know enough about the safety concerns, the other issues.
So
I think be an inmate.
You bet.
Anybody else who's in the facility?
You bet.
I don't have a problem.
Any other visitor, right? So yeah, we'll figure out this for the next version, and of course, then you know, like at some point, look, my take is, you know, not being as familiar, you know, there are a lot of collateral uses of this kind of contraband list in the exceptions, which again. Look, we're talking about a separate criminal offense, and that, like, maintaining that frame is one thing. Now, it may be that DOC uses the same list of contraband for administrative purposes right over here, but those two need not, link up. And same thing with the exception here. We can make an exception as to is it a separate criminal offense for somebody who had the needle for the, you know, prescribed to them, meets all these requirements. But it's against the administrative regs to have it outside of the infirmary. So that may be different than current use, where the two are lined up, right? And so I think that's an issue.
I don't disagree with that. Yeah. Again, for me, it's the public safety aspect of it. If you're going to have a shank that's illegal for them to have, there may be some needles and syringes that could be just as dangerous to just have in somebody's cell or locker.
You
bet. That's where the concern.
Yeah, but would say that is a serious concern.
Then it may warrant keeping it criminal and having them go to check out their syringe when they need to get the diabetes shot.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. And that's okay, yeah. If that's open, then right. That's the thing you need to explore, and appreciate your help kind of, you know, checking with DOC on that. But
okay. Yes, I have looked at the regulations and the handbook and everything. It doesn't perfectly align now, so there are things that are you're not allowed to have that aren't criminal, and there are things that are criminal that you will automatically have effective consent to have, depending on where you're staying or which block you're on. But okay, and the last thing on contraband. Sorry, I'm cutting into time on this other report, but really just had again to do with the staff secure locations. So in current law, contraband offense doesn't apply to halfway houses. But under the revised contraband offense, it would apply to halfway houses. And that raises this larger question about whether all of the different categories of contraband make sense in these staff secure locations. And I think there might be different intuitions about it for adult and juvenile again. For example, like having weapons in a halfway house, PDS is noted, is already separately criminalized as having drugs, but there might be different intuitions about whether juveniles should have drugs in a shelter house or a cell phone in a shelter house versus having a cell phone in a halfway house. So I guess I just wanted to, first of all, make sure that I really understand PDS's position about whether the objection is to having those things that are separately criminalized also treated as contraband in a halfway house, or if there are some items that you do think should be contraband in a halfway house?
Nothing should be contraband in a halfway house. But things are either illegal or they're not, and they're standalone illegal. But that, like, well, ropes and
uniforms
and stuff don't, uniforms
so,
don't
so,
make
some
sense
of these things
in a halfway
clearly
house.
Don't make sense.
And the other things, a weapon or an illegal controlled substance, those are already crimes, whether I'm doing it at grandma's house or I'm doing it in a shelter, or I'm doing it in my home or I'm doing it in a halfway house.
Halfway houses are very good at enforcing these provisions, right? I mean, if people are people are coming in with drugs, they call the police immediately. Police are there. They're normally close by or there already. People have a new charge, and then people are remanded to the jail for violating the rules of the halfway house. And so
yeah.
A standalone extra offense when you already are getting sent back to the jail or to the jail, and there is this the substantive offense.
So the shelter houses don't have that same mechanism that DOC has to just remand back to the jail. So I guess the next sort of natural question is, should the shelter houses be included because they don't have that same sort of administrative mechanism to just remand somewhere else? And because having drugs with kids might be different than having drugs in a facility with adults, or...
It's not.
Okay.
It's not. I mean, you know, the council treats kids the exact same way when it comes to drugs. They did when they made the decisions about marijuana, and, you know, and if it's illegal, it's illegal, and when it's decriminalized, it was decriminalized for everybody.
Except the Court of Appeals didn't view it the same way. Right? There was a case where a juvenile was selling, in fact, the only case on 16.3.10 that I'm aware of, maybe it's the second, where Judge Easterly ruled that for an adult to sell drugs at a park, and she wouldn't consulting adults, but I didn't know anything in the record that had that in there, was a danger to the community, but a juvenile selling drugs in the park was not a substantial danger to the community.
Okay, I don't know what the case you're talking about, but it strikes me that substantial probably mattered a lot. But in any case, having drugs in a shelter house is, I'm not sure what's going on in the park, but in any case, it is criminal or it's not criminal, and it can be enforced in that way. We're not, you know.
Could I just ask OAG's position on halfway houses and then on shelter houses?
Under current law, what's the current law?
Halfway houses are not included in the contraband statute currently. I was trying to neatly have one definition of correctional facility that could apply to all of these offenses, but I'm not certain that will work well.
I don't think it'll work well anyhow.
Thanks.
Because when I read what PDS said, the first thing that came to mind was you need separate lists. Because what is dangerous in a hardware secure facility is not necessarily the same thing that's dangerous in a congregate care or halfway house facility.
Yeah.
So if that's your goal, I'm not sure that you could do that anymore.
So is there any, I guess, concern about eliminating halfway houses since they're not included?
I'm not advocating an expansion of the law.
Okay.
But for shelter houses, you think there should be a separate list? Is there any way that you would take a look at?
No, I'm saying I'm not advocating a change in the law.
Current law.
In current law. If it is not currently...
Shelter houses are included. Halfway houses are not.
That's...
Yeah, so our take is like, right, we would have to change the definition, okay, break out shelter houses and halfway houses, and then have a kind of a special different list just for halfway houses in order to, were we to follow this, you know, right?
I'm like not that's saying that I'm for expanding the list. So if it's not currently in halfway houses,
I hear you. It's just then, right, and we can break this out and parse it. It's my understanding, Patrice, correct me wrong, again, like, shelter houses are included currently.
Why?
She's checking at it.
Penal institution or secure juvenile residential facility. No, maybe it is only secured facilities. I mean, we're reading this.
You need definitions, right?
No,
is it
2603.02.
It's in 0.02.
Yeah, it just says securely detained, so I don't know if that includes staff secure or not.
No, it is or secure juvenile residence. Penal institution or secure juvenile residential facility. We would never define a shelter house or group home as a secure juvenile residential facility.
So then both would be an expansion.
Right.
And what I hear you saying now, Dave, is nobody, no expansion, therefore we've cleared this up. Thank you.
Okay, I'm done asking questions.
No worries. Good. Good. Anything else on this mix of tampering, contraband, and escape? Anything more at this point? You know, again, obviously, right. We'll do our best to move the ball forward as we can. Let's move on then to de minimis, and I'm sure there'll be instant agreement on that too. I kind of turn it over to Michael. You know, we only had one set of comments from OAG on this, and you know, Paul was not able to join us today. I believe from prior conversations he, you know, will eventually have things to say about this wherever it lands, but these are early days in some ways.
Can I just say one thing? I didn't put it in a memo, but there was one example in a memo that we sort of...
The Halloween one,
No, the Halloween one is a different one.
Okay.
That I put in the cover. I'm just talking about an example of de minimis is somebody who's hungry who steals $100 worth of food, I think was the example.
No, that was not the example.
Certainly wasn't the intent. I mean, maybe there was a typo.
No. I mean, it was. So it was. Right. So there's kind of like two sets of examples. Right. There's a sort of like on the pure triviality grounds, we don't. Mental state's not so much of an issue, and that's like, you know, stealing an apple or stealing a piece of gum. Right? Then there was the sort of mixed triviality and culpability. And so there, I think the example was a 4-3 theft prosecution brought against a depressed and recently unemployed parent who makes a spur of the moment decision to steal $100 in groceries.
Sorry,
in order, it's on page 6 of the other commentary. So to sort of like put this in legal terms, right, what we're talking about here would be someone who has something along the lines of what would a mental state that would, for in the homicide context, for example, take you from murder to manslaughter, something along the lines of like extreme emotional distress. In addition, depressed, right? So there's an element, right, of possible, like, you know, of low-level mental illness, and then we also have the $100. And a partial justification, which would be something along the lines of, you know,
so
to feed the hungry
so
children.
Let's talk about that for a second. So, $1,000? I mean, is it the mental state and the background that's important in this example, or was the $100 put in there because it had significance?
No, so the $100 was specifically, what was the importance here was to draw the distinction between the pure... pure triviality versus lower end triviality plus other mitigating circumstances. So, for example, that's why in the first set of examples we talk about intentionally stealing a single piece of chewing gum.
I'm fine with all of that. The issue I had was why the 100, whether the 100 had significance for some reason, as opposed to 1,000 or something else. Or is it everything else, and it's just steal something that they needed?
Yeah, so the idea...
So my suggestion is to remove the 100, because what I'm afraid is kickback from the community on this one.
Right.
And I'd hate to have kickback on the community if the $100 is not something, because we put so much in a commentary to explain what it means, that I don't want people arguing about $100.
So it says steal groceries?
Steal groceries, I'm fine with. That's the only reason I brought it up.
Sure.
That's exactly right.
Because then
you have the supermarkets coming back and going, well, it's one thing if they sell the steak, but $100, each person steals $100, and you're going to end up with headaches that I don't think we need.
Groceries isn't a stick of chewing gum.
That's right.
I think it's a good point.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, then.
Cool.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So, right. I mean, you know, the question, you know, I don't know what's going to be most helpful. So, Dave, you submitted your comments. It seems like as in general, OAG is tentatively on board with the overarching idea, but you guys have some questions about implementation.
Yeah, because what we're afraid of is the distinction between what is First of all, in a sense, the overall jury nullification of offenses. OAG only prosecutes misdemeanor offenses.
Right.
So we see particularly an opportunity for arguments to be made that, with the exception of maybe unauthorized use of a firearm and ammunition and DUIs, pretty much anything else we prosecute is going to be subject to this. So it's one thing to focus in on the individual circumstances of the person, as you were highlighting
right
there. It's another thing to give an open invitation, I'm not saying that you're intent, for a jury nullification argument. And so, because in our view, is the whole reason we're doing this whole project, is that it should be the legislature that controls what is legal and not legal, and they certainly have offenses in the District of Columbia that people may think de minimis. So before the City Council acted, you guys decriminalized the Metro stuff, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say this was last year, before it was decriminalized. So there would be a debate whether how significant eating on a Metro or skipping fare is. And it's one thing to have the, and our concern is, it's one thing to say, in this individual circumstance, Michael should not be prosecuted, versus Michael jumped the fair game.
Right.
Because that's then negating the offense that the City Council at that time had determined should be illegal, and especially in the whole category of fine-only offenses, which they think there should be a minimum penalty.
Right.
So that's where we're coming from. So so I didn't really have enough, and the other people who reviewed it didn't have enough to really say whether this is good or not, because that concern is out there. So that's why we talked, and I'm reading more stuff on de minimis, and what I'd like to do is maybe contact some prosecutors in the jurisdictions where de minimis is to see how it actually plays out. So with that...
So let's just focus on that particular concern. So first, I want to say that, you know, the purview of the analysis for this de minimis defense is relatively narrow and has been focused a great deal by the subsection B, right? So subsection B lays out the four factors, right? And it's basically harm and culpability. Then, you know, while there is that among other appropriate considerations piece there, the commentary then explains that any other appropriate considerations are determined by the court as a matter of law. So in terms of what the relevant concerns would be, like, you know, these are things that are either these four or if something else, it's something that the court decides as a matter of law, fits in there. Okay. So it seems like your central concern, at least in terms of what we've been discussing, is really prong one, which is about the triviality of the harm. And to be a little bit more specific, it sounds like, you know, the issue here is that when you're talking about low-level offenses, it's that you don't want jurors or, you know, more likely it seems like an OAG prosecution's judges acting as fact finders, basically substituting their own judgment as to whether something should be criminalized for the legislature. And so I think that there's I'd say two things. First, this issue is something that also comes up in general when you're dealing with like lesser evils justification offenses. And so I did a little research into those, and there is provisions that get incorporated into those lesser evil justification defenses which say something along the lines of like the morality or advisability of the statute is not a relevant consideration in evaluating the defense. Now, that idea, is a helpful one, but so I think what we're really looking for here, though, is a way to communicate that you should assume, in terms of evaluating triviality, that the offense, at least in its heartland version, is not trivial, right? And so there would have to be something other than the heartland version of it in order to weigh in favor of a finding of triviality. So a good example would be like fare evasion, for example. That's really on the lowest end of things that we might criminalize, but to have a de minimis defense to fare evasion, right, you don't want the defendant arguing that fare evasion in general is just always de minimis. It has to be that working with that assumption that fare evasion isn't de minimis, then is there something about this particular case?
So I was 5 cents short on my exit fare. That's when
right.
I jumped the
right,
gate.
Right, right, right. That's the kind of thing, right? If it was still in the books, right, we would want a presumption of legality.
But
right?
but under the example you gave before, I don't have any money to jump to do it, and I had to visit my child.
Wait, so, okay, let's just, before we want to mix in the culpability dimensions, let's just focus on the harm issue. Because, like, then, I mean, it just adds in more variables, which we can get to, but the specific concern is just the social harm at issue, the actus reus, let's say, of whatever offense, right? And you want to make that clear. And so, you know, I've spent a little time just, you know, coming up. I think it's possible to draft that either into the statute or to clarify that through commentary by saying something along the lines of in evaluating, right? So something along the lines of either the harm caused or threatened by the person's conduct is not trivial if it falls within the heartland of offense, or...
Did you want me to pull it up?
I don't think so. Or evaluation of the triviality of the person's conduct may not rest upon considerations pertaining only to the morality and advisability of the statute. Something along those lines. Now, but the next question is, who's going to be making that determination? Who's going to be weighing this? And this goes to, like, one, your first comment, which was, are these factors pure questions of fact, or are they mixed questions of fact, mixed questions of law? I think here the answer is clear. They're mixed questions of fact and law, at least particular aspects of them. Things like triviality, legitimate for whether something's a legitimate societal objective, or in the final factor, whether someone is responsible for a individual situational factor, which makes it difficult for them to follow the law. Those things would all be mixed questions of law and fact in the same way that, for example, if someone wants to argue intoxication currently in D.C. Superior Court, they have to prove that it's not voluntary, that it's not voluntary intoxication. And the question of what is or is not voluntary is a mixed question of fact and law, right? And so that, in the same way, that's how I would envision these things operating. And so that would mean, though, that, right, judges in acting in their judicial role, not their fact-finding role in a bench trial, would be able to say, no, you can't raise this argument because I'm finding as a matter of law what you're saying is not a social, let's say, for example, a socially societally legitimate objective. So let me give you a few examples of how that would play out. So let's say someone in a drug possession case argues that heroin makes people feel high, that getting high is a legitimate societal objective, and that therefore they should be able to argue that. Judge would be free to constrain the defendant from making that argument. Likewise, if the defendant in a theft case argues that his stealing food from a minority-owned store sends a message that minorities aren't welcome and that making minorities feel unwelcome is a legitimate societal objective, the court could also reject that claim as a matter of law, right? Similarly, with the question with the responsibility prong, right, where it goes to whether individual or situational factors for which the person is not responsible made it difficult for them to follow the law, just like voluntary intoxication, right? Judge would get to, as sitting in his role as legal finder, would be able to preclude that from being raised. The second question, which kind of ties into the first that you raised, is when can the judge, or sorry, I'll just read the question. You say, when a de minimis defense is raised, how does a judge decide what evidence can be excluded, given that the fact finder can consider, this is how you, what you say to be seemingly anything that the fact finder thinks goes to blameworthiness. For example, can the judge make some decision on what constitutes relevant evidence of blameworthiness, notwithstanding this expansive fact finder discretion, and if so, based on what? So first, I would say, you know, just as to what I referenced earlier, is that from our perspective, it's not completely expansive discretion to rule on anything relevant to blameworthiness. It's the four factors delineated and anything else that the court decides as a matter of law constitutes a relevant factor. Then, interpreting that, there's a two-step process. First, the court would have to ask whether the evidence presented is logically relevant to negating any of the factors identified above, and I gave you some examples of when it wouldn't be. But then the second step would be whether the court should, as a matter of common law evidentiary discretion, preclude logically relevant evidence from being introduced. So it's worth noting here that there are a few different ways that this comes up under current district practice. So first, the DCCA, like in determining the admissibility of logically relevant evidence, always weighs the probative value versus prejudicial impact. So that's just your standard evidentiary balancing. But beyond that, in the area of like criminal responsibility in particular, there are actually two places where current district law, absent any statute, DC judges just have decided that as a matter of policy, they're precluding the presentation of what otherwise would be logically relevant evidence. The first is intoxication, right? So a person who gets voluntarily intoxicated and then lacks the knowledge required for an offense should, that lack of knowledge due to intoxication is logically relevant. Yet the court has said, for policy reasons, we constrain defendants from presenting that information, evidence. The second area where a similar phenomenon happens is diminished responsibility or diminished capacity, right? So the DCCA in Bethea and then more recently in Jackson upholds a pretty stringent rule of evidence, which says it may be true that someone, because of their mental illness, didn't have the capacity to form the intent necessary for an offense, but as a matter of as a rule of evidence and for, supported by policy-based considerations, we're not going to allow defendants to make that argument. If they want to make it, if they want to put on that sort of argument, it has to go through an affirmative defense of insanity, right? So the only reason I raise these things is because it seemed like, both in our conversation and the comments, that there's a real concern that judges would somehow be constrained from narrowing and channeling the argumentation surrounding de minimis defense. And I think that that's not, shouldn't be a huge concern, because there's what judges, first of all, are routinely making decisions weighing against relevance versus prejudicial impact. But beyond that, there's standard practice in the areas of culpability that we're already dealing with where judges feel free to preclude the presentation.
One of the concerns I know back in my office was that for a lot of what we're doing, the commentary is resting on existing case laws.
Right.
On that point, right? The theft case law, the sexual assault case law. With de minimis, though, given where it is, I think my office would advocate, or is advocating, for more being in the statute.
Okay.
And less in the explanation in the commentary. Because I hear what you're saying, but there is no Court of Appeals decision that says de minimis should be considered X. It's by analogy, which a trial judge may accept or may not, which brings it to the Court of Appeals, which then gets a Court of Appeals decision. And the whole purpose of all of this in the first place, as articulated by the counsel, is so that the counsel is making those decisions. So for all of these, I know every so often I say it should be in the statute and less in the commentary, but in de minimis in particular, because it is such a change in the law, we would advocate for more of those concepts being in the code provision itself.
So I guess one question would be, you know, could you be a little bit more specific, like, you know, submit a proposal?
Yeah, maybe we can kick it around later.
Yeah.
I'm still reading all those materials you gave me last week.
Sure.
You know, it's de minimis is not something, there are things that I and other people in my office have experience with.
Right.
So when you mention, you know, escape or theft or secondary sexual assault, there's a whole history that we can rely on in the office. Nobody that I've talked with has experience with de minimis defenses and how it plays out in a courtroom. So this is very much enough to speed, which is why our memo was basically, sounds good as an idea, we'll work with you, but I'm not at the point yet where I feel that, well, I don't know anybody in my office is where we can actually speak.
Can I interject one thing real quick, Kaji, step out? One kind of other idea we I'd be curious, you know, get everybody's views on, no conclusion, but in terms of the operationalizing this, you know, again, what we kind of came up with was kind of a clear way of treating it as an affirmative defense, right? A lot of jurisdictions would have this. It is murky how this like is actually like brought up, etc. One way that this might be operationalized is also almost doing a kind of a bifurcated proceeding, that is to say, where somebody is raising this defense, it's a second stage. And I wonder, I just want to like get you all thinking about that, because what it might do is, look, particularly for misdemeanor level, you know, this is going to raise all sorts of different evidentiary concerns, right? And, you know, and trial practice is just going to shift around this to some degree. But to the extent that it is a kind of a second proceeding, it may be able to, like, disentangle this a bit. So I just put that out there as a possibility that, again, like, we're trying to find a clear way to do this where other jurisdictions haven't. And so that's another thing. So we're not going to run with that either. But, like, if you have thoughts or responses on that, we'd love to hear them, you know, separately.
The other thing is, I maybe off time, because we got to wrap up, and I've got a new meeting also.
Yeah.
But we could spend a little more time, because I typed my thinking on this into a knot at one point, that I'm not sure how to detangle, and it's probably one of those where Michael's going to let me go, no, you're confusing too entirely. But specifically, how this plays out when the offense is something like, where it's like recklessness.
Right.
So as part of our burden, we have to show that the person's conduct grossly deviated from the standard of care, and how we prove they grossly deviated, but then there's an affirmative defense that it was de minimis. I have trouble wrapping my brain around that one.
No, it's a good point. But so the way I think this would actually play out is that at least the culpability factors that operate in the context of de minimis are also the culpability factors that operate in the context of that prong two of recklessness and negligence, which is to say that in recklessness and negligence cases, you wouldn't necessarily be raising a de minimis defense. The same argument would be happening in the context of dealing with recklessness and negligence. So the way I would see the de minimis offense being raised more often is where the government's theory of prosecution is intent. In a way, the de minimis
with
defense
is just the culpability, right?
Yeah,
so the harm is like a whole separate thing, right?
But
on the culpability side of things, you're saying, it's the same. Like,
right.
It is
the reason why I was
speeding
is because that's right. I was bleeding out of my backseat. Right?
No, I got it. I got it for the gross negligence. But that's why I was having trouble to see how this happens. Somebody proves it's recklessness, and then the defense says, no, I want to put on my case on de minimis.
Right.
But to me, that's logically inconsistent.
That's right.
That de minimis plays out in a recklessness in a lot of cases.
Right.
Which does strike me as if, I don't know, but I wonder if it's a thing then you have to think about if you didn't do bifurcated. I don't know how I feel about that. Right. That we don't want to end up in that same, the position we had with force and consent in sex abuse cases, right, where we want to say, look, we want to just challenge in the government's case that it wasn't gross negligence, it wasn't a gross deviation or whatever. I don't want to get told, nope, that's a de minimis argument, that's an affirmative defense, you can't just win it by challenging the government's case.
I mean, right, yeah, there's the relationship between the gross deviation analysis for recklessness, negligence, and de minimis is a good, you know, it's a good point, and right, but you know, that's just something that would, you know, we want to have clarity on and work out. But you know, again, like that, you know, these are not like kind of like fundamental problems that cut to the sort of core of whether the minimis defense.
Well, it cuts to a segment of the offenses, depending on how that comes out.
Right. No. But I think we're all on the same page in terms of the operation. So. Yeah. And then, you know, I guess you raised a point of a question as to both, right, jury appeals. I think, you know, there's a clear answer that to the extent this is an affirmative defense and that a finding that the defendant prevails on it would lead to an acquittal, there's no appeals from acquittals.
Yes, that I got.
Right. So that's, you know.
How about the failure?
How about the...
That in a bench trial, the judge is not ruling a de minimis offense is an abuse of discretion.
Right, yeah, it'd be reviewable in the same way that a judge's decision not to allow for a duress defense or an insanity defense or, you know, or any of those things would similarly be under the same rubric, which I think is one benefit of the affirmative defense categorization is it falls within the sort of same procedural framework that all other affirmative defenses are, as opposed to like what the model penal code drafters proposed, which is kind of this vague, you know, judge, it's not clear when it gets raised, it can be raised at different times, depending on when it's raised with different issues, because it's like how developed the factual record is, and things of that nature.
Right, and that goes with the other comment about a written statement, right?
Right, yeah.
And that was, that's something in a bench trial situation that I think would be helpful.
Would be helpful, agreed. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, that's...
Good. Well,
I don't know how much more you want.
Exactly. So what we should do is we should find a time to discuss this further, and see, you know, if again there are more concrete language. I heard you saying, you know, things from the commentary and some of the things, you know, sound right, but we want to bring those into the statute. What exactly is that language? What would it look like? Because, we want to move this forward with that, and I think more specificity, it's going to be disagreement on what that specificity is, but I think given the newness of this in general, the more specific we can be, the better. Again, trying to reach, you know, as much agreement as possible is going to obviously be a challenge, but like, I think, yeah, so what, you know, from each office's perspective should come in, and again, yeah, otherwise, you know, anything else, Michael, or?
No.
Okay. Any other last thoughts or questions, or, you know, this is something to chew on. Again, what we'll get out to y'all next week is going to be, in some sense, you know, should be very familiar territory, right, in terms of Chapter 2 of the general part, a couple of months, you know, this is all, this is just, you know, kind of an update, responding to, you know, the prior comments that we received from everybody. You'll see the format, and basically you'll get your own comments back. We put it all in a nice PDF. We organize things. We're going to have, like, a separate document having, like, responses to each of the comments that we received. Oh, yeah, we're doing this up nice. And then the new statutory language
really
and comments.
Reject it. You said something nice.
Oh, we said
really
something.
Well written.
Yeah.
Oh. We are rejecting the concept.
Yeah.
Perfect. Effort. I like what the trophy for effort.
A perfect point. PDFs. Well, the RCC does not incorporate PDFs as rejection. However, the RCC does note that PDFs employed perfect grammar.
Something like that.
No,
just
I don't know. I don't know
that. Something.
That's the award the PDFs would get. But yeah. What? What?
Oh,
what?
Dang.
What? I mean, come on, folks.
Yeah.
Everybody
knows
Granada is, like, definitely the lead on grammar.
Fine, but, like, that you just implied...
I'm just saying, for grammar, first place prize, who gets... Okay, we should wrap up. Thank you all.
Yeah.
For the record,
that was not
out of the running.
Exactly.
That one, I'm fine with it.
That was a substantial
bad.
Harm.
Oh, jeez.